Hello and welcome to the Leadership Learned podcast, brought to you by the Inspirational Development Group. Each episode, we examine the behaviours, skills and attributes required to improve human performance through effective leadership. We discuss the latest thinking and issues affecting leadership from the boardroom to the classroom to provide you, whether you're a CEO, manager, graduate or student, with tangible insights to take away and use in your career and workplace as we go beyond the clichés to prove that leaders are made, not born. In this episode, we'll be talking about mental toughness, very relevant to all of us in these current tumultuous times. We discuss what it is, what it isn't, and how, contrary to popular belief, it can be developed and strengthened using psychometrics and diagnostics. We talk about the difference between modern psychometrics that are flexible and adaptive to different personality types and contexts, and old-fashioned personality tests that simply force people into a small number of archetypes. We go on to detail how to use these psychometrics to improve your mental toughness and gain a true 360-degree view of yourself as a leader in multiple scenarios, and why that is so important to being an effective leader. I'm Matthew Moore, I'm your host, and I'm joined again by leadership guru Nigel Girling, who has been a CEO of multiple organisations, a government task force member and a touring session guitarist, and Dr. Rona McKenzie, an experienced leader in education and business with more qualifications than a cat has lives. Before we got into mental toughness, I started the discussion by asking Rona to elaborate on what psychometric tools are for people like me who may have a limited knowledge of them.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, like you, I came to psychometric tools very late in life. So I spent 20 years working in schools, and the only time I was ever asked to complete a psychometric was when I was applying for headship. And actually, that was used as a recruitment tool, the results of which I didn't see. And so I'm not quite sure what it said about me. But it's interesting that in education, particularly, that they weren't, and this may be different now, but they weren't typically used. When we look at there's many psychometrics out there, and they tell us all sorts of different things, but in essence, what they're doing is they're helping us to understand how we show up in the world. And that might be how we behave in terms of our emotional intelligence. It might be how we behave as a leader or a follower of leaders. It can be all sorts of things. And so they're very useful to just help us to shine a light on how we show up, how we behave at that point in time, and then what that might mean for our interactions with other people and teams in the world. And so since leaving education and going in, I did my first psychometric after that when I did my MBA. We used a particular one looking at us as leaders and how we were behaving. And over the years, I've done a number now, and I find it fascinating because every time I do one, I feel like I've opened another little door into the world of me. And that sounds a little bit navel-gazing-y, but actually it means I'm starting to work out how I'm developing as I'm getting older, how I'm growing as I become more experienced, how I'm maybe not growing because I'm getting older and becoming more stuck in my ways, and how I might flex and adapt. I think the best thing I was ever taught in my leadership career was that the only behavior I can change is my own, not that of anybody else's. And when you lead hundreds of children, you know that you can't change any of their behavior. They'll do what they want when they want. And if you remember that you are in control of your own behavior, and how you behave will impact on how others interact with you. So by knowing yourself a bit better helps you to behave slightly differently so that you can get the best results with people and for shared goals. So yeah, I find them fascinating. And Nigel and I have been looking at all sorts of psychometrics. And when he shared the mental toughness one with me, I mean, I thought, oh, this is about how tough am I? Am I a tough cookie? And then what's been fascinating is learning what it really means.
The terminology that gets used around a lot of these diagnostic psychometric assessments can be counterproductive sometimes, I think, in that it conveys the wrong meaning. And I think mental toughness is a good case in point, because it's not actually about being tough in the way most people think of tough. It's about tough in terms of bounce back ability, of the ability to withstand challenge, stress and pressure and come back stronger. It's that kind of resilience. So it's not about being completely incapable of being affected by anything. It's about not weakening, even though you have been. It's about maintaining resolve and focus and direction and intent, despite the fact that you're getting the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune chucked at you. one of the things that particularly attracted me to actually being involved as a sort of neuroscientist in the first place, actually, was that a growing understanding of the way the brain works has proved to us that actually nothing is fixed. And when I was first coming up in my leadership career in 1873, it was about you were who you were by the time you were a grown up, and there, that's what you were stuck with. And now your job was to get the most out of it. Whereas we now know, because we've understood more about neuroplasticity, that actually it changes every day and that you can change it on purpose. And one of my favorite words that I encountered, which I'm not sure is even a real word, is habituation, which just means doing stuff a lot. You know, but it's an interesting version of it, because it does say what it means, in that a lot of our brain function is shaped by habit, mm-hmm. repetition, yeah. iterations of habit. And so actually it's in your gift. Mm-hmm. You can decide what those habits are. You can change them. It's not easy, but it's mm-hmm. not impossible either. So this is a particularly rich field for people to understand more about how they can develop themselves. Mm. I think that's probably the critical thing for me. This is about self-awareness.
Yeah.
See, there's a very interesting TED talk by an American doctor called Dr. Tasha Urick, and she talks about self-awareness unicorns. She did a load of research where lots of people were asked how self-aware they thought they were, and something like 85 to 90% of people thought they were extremely self-aware, but then when they did the research, actually only about 10% of them actually were.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, so significant, particularly for somebody in a leadership role.
Yeah. I think people assume, because they've thought about how they lead, that they and that they're seeing themselves accurately. Mm-hmm. And it's not until you stop. And I know that we complete these psychometrics, so it is our perception of us. Mm-hmm. But still, the things that I've found out about myself, I've done that classic, that's not me, when I've read mm-hmm. what the profile says, and then thought, oh, hang on a minute. Actually, if I'm honest with myself, it is exactly how I show up. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's now really interesting. And then you can appreciate why other people interact with you in the ways that they do, or why challenges or barriers that we perceive, why we're able to overcome them or not. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I can quite see why that research found that out.
Yeah. Just to play the sort of devil's advocate on this, and I know certainly other people, this is how I feel generally about them before I sort of started getting a bit more interested in them, is, and you touched on this briefly, Rona, the slim categorization of people and putting me into these 6 or 8 categories, and how does that fit, and how is it different from horoscopes? You know, it's that feeling that you can't pigeonhole me. I'm, you know, there are 7 billion people on this planet. How can they all fit within 8 archetypes or whatever? And I just wanted to know a bit about how you see psychometrics recognizing those little differences.
Yeah, I find that interesting, because I was doing a particular psychometric with a company, and the leaders there had already done this psychometric about 5 years previously, and they brought their previous reports. And that test was looking at, or that piece of work was looking at, how they behaved as leaders. And we looked at how they changed over time. And what we're looking for always is their ability to flex across many different styles, so that when they interact with others who are different to them, they can be more accommodating or understanding, and just adapt the way they are. So if you're the kind of person that likes to get things done now, and you're not worried about the detail, and then you meet someone who really cares about the detail, you don't dismiss that and crack on regardless. Actually, you just take a moment and stop and look at the detail with them before moving forward. So you take them with you. And so many of these great psychometrics are looking at our ability to adapt and flex, our ability to see how we've developed over time. And they were able to say, well, when I did that psychometric 5 years ago, I was in that particular role. And now I'm in a new role, and I can see how I've developed over that course of time. And now I am able to flex more because of my experiences as a leader, as an individual. And so I think that language around, I'm not pigeonholing anybody into a place. What I'm saying is, at the moment, this is how you're showing up at particular times and in a particular context. Because, of course, these are our behaviours. If you're in one workplace, you may feel very different to you would in another workplace. If you filled it in with your work life or your private life, you might show up slightly differently. And so in some tests, so it's interesting to consider Why are we doing it? What are we focusing on? What are we going to learn from it? And then it's not an excuse for behaving this way. I am like this, so you'll just have to take me as I am. But it's actually around just an understanding of what it feels like to be on the receiving end of you.
Right, right. I see. Because Nigel, I know you know a lot more about the sort of the finer detail and the science behind everything. And what is it for you that makes psychometrics, modern psychometrics, robust?
I'm just going to bask for a moment in the thought that I might know a lot about something. That's quite good. My father would never have believed it, but or my school reports either, for that matter. I guess there's a couple of important things following on from what Rona just said, one of which is that, and it goes back to your question, really, which is I'm always very, very suspicious of any kind of assessment which pigeonholes you. The best ones don't. They show you in a graduated scale. They say, you know, you have a tendency in this particular way, and therefore it's likely to be true that if you've scored at the very high end of something, you probably are quite high in that, but you might be less high tomorrow than you are today, or higher tomorrow than you are today. But you're not going to go from being 10 out of 10 to 1 out of 10, because that's not how people are unless you do have some serious mental disorder. Mm-hmm. Which many leaders, I suspect, probably do. That's what makes you want to do this ridiculous job. But so I'm always most, I find most compelling the kind of assessments that say you are somewhere on a continuum, and that accept the fact that you will move up and down that continuum, but right. You probably won't go from one end to the other. Mm-hmm. You'll move around within certain confines, if you like.
Okay.
And that's much more useful. But Rona's point is well made there, that really it's not about, if you do one assessment, what you've just done is looked at yourself from one angle. Yeah, you know, great. If that was your best side, then crack on. Well done. But what about the other side?
You know? Right, right.
I just worked with a guy years ago who was a professor of this in one of the big American universities. And he produced an assessment which was called the dark side, which was about derailers. It was about saying, well, if you have these strengths and then put them into a different set of circumstances, they're not strengths anymore.
Right.
They're now derailers.
Uh-huh.
Like I still remember mine where that I was bold, mischievous, colourful and imaginative, which I really liked until he explained to me what that might mean to other people and under certain circumstances. So for me, it was more important to be colourful than to be right or to be helpful. Or to be purposeful. You know, I was much more interested in wearing my brightly coloured shirts. Don't do that anymore, obviously. And my colourful ties and things, because that's who I thought I was. You know, I was that peacock guy. Than I was to actually do something that was conducive to what we were trying to achieve. And so my bold, you know, colourful and imaginative bit was actually a good thing when that's what you needed. What I hadn't learned was how to be the other thing.
Mm.
Or the other 50 things, or the other 6,000 things, yeah. Right. And so that thing about adaptation is so important. That ability to flex that Rona mentioned is the crucial capability of a leader. And the more of these perspectives you've got from different angles about yourself, the more you know about what's in your toolbox.
Mm.
The more you know which thing to select, you know.
I've just been talking to people today about helping a team to be more effective. Mm. And it's very easy to say, oh, well, here's some models for running meetings, or here's a problem solving model, or here's a team alignment model. But actually, if you don't understand how you behave in as a person, as a leader, and how you interact with other people, it doesn't matter how many models and structures and tools you stick over the top. Inherently, you'll all default to your typical behavior. And if you are disagreeing and you can't find ways to problem solve together, just by having a tool that's not necessarily going to help. Once you start to understand why conflict arises because you work in different ways, oh, actually, now we're understanding difference. And when we think about diversity and inclusion, diversity is the difference, you know, and actually then how do we work with that difference? How do we harness it? This person, I think that they just have stupid ideas. Actually, they might have really good ideas if we'd found a different way to work together to harness them. And so the difference starts to become something we appreciate and we work with for the good of all of us, rather than just going, you just annoy me.
Yeah.
Actually, it's nothing to do with that. Yeah, and it takes, I think it helps people to see people in a different light and appreciate difference as a good thing rather than just being a problem, so to speak.
Yeah, you said a whole bundle there. That's some critical stuff in there. This thing about difference. That for a lot of people, difference is threatening because we don't know what to do with it. Yeah, we're most comfortable with people that we are find familiar, that do things in ways that we can identify with, that are a bit like us, maybe. And of course, the key to solving complex problems and particularly dealing with dilemmas where there is no known solution or with complexity is difference. I can't solve everything, clearly. But with six other people who can think completely differently and have different experiences and perspectives, maybe we can. But that's hard to accept, particularly if you're trying to make your mark. You know, I think it's particularly hard for leaders who are still feeling slightly like they've got to prove themselves. Mm. They think they do that by doing more and being more visible and being louder and all these kind of things. And actually, just keeping your gob shut and letting other people contribute might well be the smartest thing you can do, but it doesn't look very heroic.
And that's where I find it interesting that organisations will look for leaders in a team that are different, so that we can get different perspectives, way of looking at problems or looking at detail or so on and so forth. But then what we don't do is then say, okay, we're all different. How are we going to make this work? Mm. And then in Matthew Syed's book, Rebel Ideas, in there, he talks about the Enigma Code and where they brought together to crack the code. They brought together people from such a wide, varied set of backgrounds and also from different stratospheres of leadership, so to speak. Mm. One of the key people, I think, was he was a crosswords, really good at solving crosswords. And so what they did brilliantly there, that we'll never know how they did it, was they managed to bring people with different experiences and expectations and hierarchy and get them to work effectively to solve a common problem. And in there, they must have worked out, well, my strength's this and yours is that. And how will we bring this and listen and find great solutions together? So that's where the psychometrics tell us a whole world of information. The trick is, how are we going to use that for good effect, both as an individual and as teams?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's crucial. And the mental toughness thing is sort of at the heart of this, the one we're mostly going to be talking about today, because it talks about, really, about thinking patterns. It is about, yes, it's mental toughness, as the name suggests, but what that really comes from is the way you think about stuff, the way you perceive information, the way you compute it, analyze it, and draw conclusions from it in your head. And each of us does that slightly differently.
That does sound quite different to the way you would perceive it to be, because, you know, it kind of sounds like it would be interchangeable with resilience. It's that kind of a thing, whereas what you're talking about is a lot more nuanced.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, because, yeah, it does often get talked about as if it's another term for resilience. And there is definitely a family resemblance there. But what mental toughness is about to what extent is your mental process therefore robust in the face of challenge? So when you are challenged significantly, put under extreme pressure, how do you compute that in your head? Do you view that as terrible, horrifying, threatening, and something to be escaped from? Or do you view it as fascinating, as an opportunity to kind of do something really interesting and expect that you will prevail? So it has these facets within it of commitment and challenge and confidence that are about your ability to deal with that stuff. You know, can you actually make sense out of those various types of challenge so you can exert some kind of control, with the other fourth C. So for all of us, each one of these things is significant, but it's the combination and interaction of them that is the most significant. And that's where something like a mental toughness assessment adds a huge layer of additional flavor to the things that Rona was talking about. These are the behavioral, the social and emotional intelligence, the fluid intelligence. Those things are all important facets. This one kind of like underpins them, because those other things are generally the result of the way you're wired and the way your brain perceives things, because that's, you know, that's the matrix. That's your filter for the world. There's a great line at the end of I think it's the last Harry Potter movie where Harry says to Dumbledore, "Is this real then, or is it just happening in my head?" He said, of course it's happening in your head. Well, does that mean it isn't real? And for me, that was, I had a kind of a real epiphany moment in that. And it's a, and it's just a film, but that's so true, you know.
Yeah.
What we think of as real is the stuff that we've decided in our own heads. If somebody else's real is entirely different. And my wife and I know this from every time we're choosing a color or a new piece of furniture. We might be looking at the same color or the same piece of furniture, but we're not seeing the same thing very clearly. One of my jackets that I think is brown that she thinks is green, and she knows she's right, but I can't see it. That's not how it looks to me.
So why is this important particularly in a professional context?
I guess if as I believe, the mental toughness thing is sort of like the bedrock of our personality, our behavior, our preferences, our emotional intelligence, all these other things, then we need to understand what our baseline is. Now, if we have a certain level of confidence in our own ability, is one of the measures of the mental toughness thing, that permeates through everything else. You know, because if you have a too high a level of confidence in your own abilities, you'll become potentially reckless, potentially push things in the wrong direction, will attempt things that might cause damage to you, yourself, others, and your organization. So that then might be tempered by your attitude to risk, which is another one of the measures. So, but if you're high in both of those, that's a warning light. Because in the right context, that can be fantastic. In the wrong context, that could be horrific. It depends how it's applied. But it then will then be filtered through your emotional intelligence, how you perceive people around you and how you interact with people and your fluid intelligence, your ability to solve complex problems, all these kinds of things. So this is a web of things. And the mental toughness thing is very important because it helps you to understand why a lot of the other stuff is the way it is. I would always recommend and do always recommend to leaders when they're doing these things that they do three or four different assessments, because that way you get a more rounded picture, and they, each of them has an impact on the others. Unfortunately, a lot of organizations, they use one as a recruitment tool, forget to give the report to the people that they've actually just done the assessment, and then never look at it again. And that's such a missed opportunity for such valuable information that could have been really helpful and informative over the long term.
Yeah. I also think they do them too late. So we know that leadership isn't taught in schools typically, although that's what we're working to change across the world. But also that young people don't really know who they are or how they show up in the world and why life, that they themselves don't make sense to themselves. And so one of the pieces of work I'm doing now is looking at how we use these different types of profiles to help young people when they're sort of 16 to 18, before they go out into the big wide world, to understand how they are, how they show up when they go to university or they go and get their first job. How will they interact with other people? And once you start to know that you are very orientated by learning, you want to learn and achieve, you achievement is your orientation. If you know that about yourself or not, do you learn from prior mistakes or less so? How confident are you? All of these different elements, and you can start to understand where you might find things challenging. And this I'm tying this into coaching so that young people can say, I've done my MTQ profile and this is what it said about me. So what does that mean? And let me spot that about myself. What I love about psychometrics is when you catch yourself doing something and go, oh, that's that thing. I do that thing that I said I didn't do. But also then when you work with other people, you can see how they approach things and realize why you're different. How do you need to work together to make sure that both of you feel comfortable?
Enough, at least.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think if we started earlier on in our lives, looking at ourselves in a little bit more detail and having people coach us through understanding who we are and how we behave, then I think that sets us up for a much more fruitful and enjoyable encounter with the world and all the people in it and the richness of all of those people in terms of their personalities and their behaviours.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I feel like you go out into the world in the dark. And we always say in schools, then they don't understand themselves. It's the hormones. It's this, it's that. Actually, when you talk to young people, they know a lot about themselves and what they their values are, what they're striving to achieve, what matters to them. Mm. Sometimes they're not really sure what that looks like in the way they behave, and they get frustrated because they behave in certain ways and don't understand the response that comes back. That doesn't compute. Whereas once you start to see how you cope with challenge, or you know how you if your life, if you're out of control of things, what's your response? Once you start to understand that about yourselves and you know something's on the horizon that's going to change your life, like going into a new job, leaving home, whatever it might be, okay, how am I going to turn up in the world on that day when that thing happens? Probably like this. What do I need to do to help me cope so that that's a successful encounter for me? So yeah, I find it really interesting. I'm most interested in how do we get people to start looking at this earlier in their lives than later.
I was going to say with young people, I would have thought it would be less productive because they're changing so rapidly. But then I suppose what you've been saying is that a lot of the benefit of psychometrics is doing it a lot, doing it, doing multiple, so you can track the changes a bit better.
Yeah, and of course, going back to what I was saying about neuroplasticity, when I can say it, that's true for everybody. We just know it's true with young people, whereas we try to pretend it isn't true with adults. But if you think about how you are now compared to how you were 15 years ago, stuff happens, doesn't it? Things move. You know, we are all changing all the time to varying degrees and in different ways.
Talking about that neuroplasticity thing, just because I find that quite interesting in regards to is our ability to learn and change, literally change our sort of pathways and what have you, does that change as we get older? Is it diminished, or you know? Because I know certain people would say, you know, they get to a certain age and that's it. You know, they know what they know.
Up until pretty recently, we thought you were pretty much done by the time you're in your 40s. There's a lot of very interesting work going on at places like the OU at the moment, the Open University, where they're looking at dementia and finding that actually you can change people's neural pathways even when they're in the early stages of dementia, when they're maybe 80 years old. We are always able to change. It becomes more difficult in some ways sometimes, but what actually happens is that people stop trying. Go back to Rhoda's point about, you know, you using these results as an excuse, because I am like that, so put up with it. Sometimes people use it as a way of not having to try. Oh yeah, well, I'm naturally that, so there's no point in me doing anything about it. Well, okay. But if it's formed by habituation, you know, by doing stuff a lot, then do something else a lot. Go back to Malcolm Gladwell's thing about the outliers and the 10,000 hours, you know, that there's a reason that Cristiano Ronaldo is so good at taking free kicks. And it's not because he was born being brilliant at free kicks. Because when everybody else has finished training, 3 hours later in the rain, he's still out there, even now at 38, practicing free kicks. Gary Player said that many years ago, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
So we're sort of touching now on the sort of practical things that people can do. What else is there apart from a lot of practice? What sort of other things can people work on their mental toughness?
Being a naturally a reflector and a theorist rather than an activist, I don't really want to do stuff. Just want to talk about stuff or read about stuff, think about stuff. For me, reflection is a critical aspect of this. Thinking about it a lot, you know, really thinking about what this stuff means to you, not just scanning the report and going, oh yeah, that's interesting, and then binning it, but actually keeping it beside you and looking again the following week and the week after and 3 months later.
I think it goes hand in hand with coaching perfectly in the sense that, and I used it at home. You know, I was saying to you earlier, we're in the process of moving home. And as ever, it's not smooth sailing. The chain's complex and we're trying to work out how to navigate our way through this with as little stress as possible. which is an interesting challenge. But actually what I've learned through my MTQ profile is that my approach, I don't see any of this as an issue. Nothing's a problem. It's just a challenge. And there are just different routes to the end solution. And so my way of coping and reducing my stress is to have lots of options that are well planned and well thought through and are all initiated very slightly so that if at a moment's notice I need to do something different, it's fine because I've thought that through. And I kind of see it as like little runs of dominoes, you know, the Lego runs where they're all stood up, someone tips the first little Lego brick and they all fall down. I've got lots of those little runs ready to roll, and it doesn't matter which one you tip over, I'm good with all of them. So I can cope, whereas I've learned that my partner, it doesn't work in that way. And so some of the potential tipping of the first domino can provoke a response in him, which is entirely different and could be stressful for him. And so rather than my response is, it's fine, I've got plan A, B and C. Don't worry about it. Actually, he's out of control of that because I have complete control. That for some people will make them feel even worse because that's even more stressful. So it's helping me not only to work out how I typically behave, but then consider what's that impact of my behavior going to be on him and what might we need to talk about so that he feels okay with the decisions we're making and the course of action we follow. So I'm a doer. I don't want to leave him behind as I've cracked on and leave him concerned. So it's not just about me. It's about me and then how I will be interacting with others and how I might then choose to do other things in between to make sure that things go smoothly for the people that are closest to me, whether that's at home or at work. So now I can self-coach myself and spot those things more so now and adapt my behavior. Other people can't necessarily do that because they're not naturally reflective. And I think that's why couples go for marriage counseling. It's why, you know, overseas, my partner's Canadian, American, Canada, the therapy is not a swear word or thing to be frightened of. Yeah. It's life. It's what we do. Yeah. And it's a shame that we don't have that approach in the UK, because actually what we're doing is reflecting on our life, and we are helping ourselves to understand ourselves better. And so we're helping ourselves to develop our behaviors. It is the best thing we can do. So once people can get over the fact that there's nothing wrong, it's not a sticking plaster, actually it's about a growth tool, then to have coaching with a different person for the reason that you need it at that point in your life. Not one coach forever, but a coach for a period of time with a particular focus, and then not, and then a different coach with a particular focus, and so on. So that I think I almost feel like you know, when you like scratch off the surface and a picture emerges underneath, I feel like we're like that. We're scratching off the surface of different bits of us and working out how the world sees us so that we can change how we choose to be.
That's a great way of looking at it. And I think you've sort of started answering this question. It's something I asked Nigel the other day, but how does one know in this circumstance, if that's the sort of thing you want to work on, you want to work on your mental toughness, how does one know whether to get a mentor, a coach or a therapist?
Yeah, my unhelpful answer was all three. But
you were talking about me, so that's fair enough.
But it's true, isn't it? I mean, what you actually need, it's the same thing as choosing the psychometrics. You need different perspectives for different purposes. A mentor can kind of help you think about things in practical terms of what you might do to further your career, to improve your impact, because that's their focus. A coach can hold up a mirror to you so you can see yourself more clearly. A therapist can help you deal with some of the neuroses that we've all built up over time and kind of bring it out there and have a look at it and go, actually, that's pretty normal, really. I remember spending years worrying about certain aspects about myself that I now get paid for. And at school, you know, I was punished routinely for doing exactly the thing that I've done as a career ever since. And so it's contextual, isn't it? So actually what I think the self-coach term that Ronnie uses is critical here, because in the end, you've got to be able to do what coaches call adopt third position. You've got to be able to stand to one side and observe yourself Listen to yourself speaking, like look at how you react and respond to things, have an out of body experience, because I find that incredibly helpful. And sometimes I do literally stop in the middle of a sentence and think, stop doing that.
Yes. Yeah. I did that. Yeah. Last week I heard myself say something and then stopped and said, ah, that might have sounded like I was being like this. That's not my intention.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to sound like that. And I just want to check with you how it landed, because I could hear myself and I could hear my tone and that wasn't my intention.
Yeah.
And I think back to your question, Matt, I think if you, a coach will ask you the questions to help you to think about who you are and how you show up in the world. And so the psychometrics will help give you a sense of something to focus on, to consider. It's not a truth, it's a perspective and something to harness your, to hang your thinking around. I would always say before you're entering into therapy with someone else or even developmental work with anyone else, you need to know yourself first, because how can you possibly work out how you're showing up if you don't know you? And so if it's going to be impacting on others, look at you first, put the lens on you, and don't see that as a negative thing. That's always a positive. It's great to spend time. What I find really interesting is we spend lots of time in the gym training our bodies to be healthy, and we worry about what we eat, how much we sleep, and so on. We do very, very little for our minds.
Yeah,
they're the thing that direct everything we do.
Absolutely.
So committing as much money and time to your brain as you do to your body, the rest of your body, is really, really important.
Exactly that. Yeah. Hear. It's true, isn't it? Priorities are interesting. And I think probably in Britain, and particularly I think in England, actually, it's a very English thing not to want to look too closely at yourself, because it seems a bit like being self-obsessed.
And it can be deeply uncomfortable as well when you hear yourself or see yourself and think. And the classic goes back to when I started teaching, they video you and you watch yourself back. I remember cringing and realizing that my verbal tick was, I would say, okay then, about 1,000 times. But what that helped me to do was not say okay then in the way I had done before. And this is the same. This is around, again, looking at how we behave and what's the impact of that, and is that okay or not? And if not, well, you have to do something different yourself. Nobody else will. So the fun part is trying things out, doing things differently to see what the impact is. So if I don't say the same sentence in a different way, what's the impact on other people? If I sit in a different seat in the meeting, rather than sitting next to the person I always sit with, rather than giving my opinion first, if I listen to the opinions of everybody else and share mine last, what's the impact on those people? If I sit in a different angle, all these lots and lots of things, ways we behave, you get to try them out and see. And that's not that you're trying to catch people out, but what you're looking to see is, how can we get the best from all of us by being different? So
exactly that. I think it's so important. I think I remember maybe 30 years ago in the early days as a CEO, I would naturally be gobby and dominate the meeting and tell everybody what I thought about stuff, because I thought that's what you were supposed to do, you know? And when I first had a coach who said, just shut up. Try that. See how that goes. And so I did. And the first couple of times I did it, it caused a fair amount of mayhem, because everybody was looking at me, so trying to see what my opinion was before they gave theirs. But after a while, people started saying what they thought. And if, as long as the first few times you go, that's great, let's go with that. Even if it's nonsense, let's go with that. You've got to build, empowering people takes habituation too. You've got to do this stuff for a while until it becomes a habit. Otherwise, it's just a trick.
So at what point, Nigel, did you decide to stop following that advice and just let yourself
fall? What's it going to IDG? That is a truth, actually. There's a truth in that. As you get older, one of the things that I've found happens is that you become less bothered about the impact you're having on other people and start in reveling in it. I have to be really careful of that, because I undoubtedly do just cause mischief.
If you say that, I remember my mum saying when she got to 60, I worry less about what other people think now, so I'm able to be a little bit more honest.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law once said to me that when she was 20, she cared desperately about what everybody thought about her. when she got to 40, she realised that she didn't really care that much about what people thought about her. And when she got to 60, she realised they weren't thinking about her to begin with, so it didn't matter.
I love that.
Yeah, I thought that was going to be a Les Dawson joke you were going to put together. Start up with the mother-in-law.
No, not on this podcast.
But it's true, isn't it? It's very interesting, this, because actually what you're saying here, I think, is that the critical issue here is building positive relationships. Because if you have positive relationships, then variation is acceptable. Yeah. If you're having a good day or a bad day, other people will give you a certain amount of leeway because they know who you really are and who you normally are.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, that if you're never authentic, people never really understand you or value the real you.
Yeah.
You end up role-playing. And I've seen so many leaders over the years who just role-playing what they think a leader's job looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a byproduct of things like imposter syndrome. Sometimes people will think, well, the real me isn't going to be good enough, so I've got to pretend to be this other person that is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And actually, you got the job for a reason, a bunch of reasons. Be you. It's fine.
So to summarize what we've been talking about today, then, I think there are several lessons that we can pull out. And first of all, we talked about psychometrics, which are the benefits that people can gain when used as a commitment to learn through many different techniques and areas, in that they help identify and take advantage of your differences and your strengths. We talked about mental toughness being the understanding of what's happening and having a range of tools to help to get through those things. And it's about making sense of things as well as being sort of resolute in the face of them. We talked about being aware of the fact that knowing all of this helps you personally with your interactions with other people and your ability to do so effectively. And in terms of tips and how people can improve their mental toughness, we talked about practice, reflection, coaching, analysing the impact of your behaviours and how that was particularly important. And then as a consequence of that, we talked a little bit about the difference between and the benefits of the different types of help available. And finally, we were talking about how all of this is part of being an authentic leader. And you need a combination of these methods. And everything that we've been talking about in recent weeks and we're going to be talking about in other weeks as well. And the final lesson I've got for myself is I'm going to pick up on every time Rona says, okay, then.
Because yeah, you know what that really means is, now just go and get on with it.
Okay, then.
Good. Well, thanks for your input this week. It's been a really good discussion. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Leadership Learned podcast. If you'd like to learn more about some of the things we've talked about, please see the show notes for links. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do subscribe. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the themes discussed today. You can find us on LinkedIn by searching Inspirational Development Group, or you can email us on info@inspirationaldg.com. If you'd like to learn more about IDG and the work we do optimizing human performance through leadership development, you can find us at www.inspirationaldevelopment.com. We'll see you next time.